Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk. With me today are Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Austin is an author, columnist, blogger, and contributor to StrategyPage.com. Jim is a military analyst, consultant for the U.S. military, and well-known author. On Strategy Talk, we discuss current events with our own unique twist. We report news as history. Austin and Jim, welcome this morning. Nothing like a little pandemic to get your day started. It looks like the world's all a Twitter about what's happening with the swine flu. The question is you know, how serious this really is and what sort of effects it's going to have on international borders and like that.
Well, let's put it in perspective first. You know, all this panic is mainly from ignorance. The flu is basically a virus. Everybody knows that. So is the cold, so is smallpox, so is polio. A lot of diseases operate, you know, with a virus. The flu, like the common cold, comes around in cycles every year. Recent research has found out, for example, that it doesn't jump from one host to another. It goes, you know, you can sneeze and it spreads, unless the weather's cold. That people have suspected for years. Somebody finally went out and did the research. The damn virus just does not live unless it's cool. The problem with any virus, especially the rhinovirus, the cold virus, which I get, and the influenza virus, which I don't get, see, not everybody is susceptible to these viruses. The influenza virus, which affects the, rather than the nose like the rhinovirus, it affects the upper respiratory tract, the lungs, you know, all that stuff up there we breathe through. It mutates. All viruses mutate, but some mutate rapidly. And the problem with the influenza virus is that it also jumps from species to species. This is rare. In fact, the American Indians, before the Europeans came, didn't have influenza because influenza is most virulent, most deadly, when it jumps from another species. And it arose basically in Eastern Asia, in China basically, that's where it mostly came from, because people lived in close proximity to pigs. Same thing, you know, throughout Eurasia. You had a lot of domesticated animals, and that allowed, you know, animal flu to jump to another species that was close. Pigs are very close physiologically to humans. And when you get hit with a alien but, you know, compatible virus, it's more deadly. That's why there was all the big stink in the last few years about the bird flu, because birds aren't as close as pigs or swine, and the deadliest virus can be an avian virus jumping to another, you know, another species. The problem is how different it's going to be, and that's how deadly it's going to be. Influenza is an annual event. It's going on all the time. Normally, it kills about 36,000 people a year in the United States, which is a big number, but we're used to it, you know, kills more people than guns or automobile accidents. Worldwide, in a bad year, up to 500,000, usually closer to 300,000. That's worldwide. Now, that's a lot of people getting killed, but because it happens every year, we don't get excited about. What people are getting excited about now is the pandemic. In other words, a really nasty variation, you know, mutation of the flu virus. The one that's happening now does not appear to be it. There are two things that make a killer flu, a pandemic. One is a high rate of infection, and two is a high death rate. Normally, only if maybe 5-10% of the entire population in a normal year catches the flu. Of those people who catch the flu, 1 in 1,000 die. And that's where you get your 36,000 dead, you know, per year, 40,000, whatever, dead in the United States. Mostly it's people who have weak immune systems. A really bad flu, like the worst one in recorded history is the 1918, you know, Spanish flu. That one infects more of the population. It's up to 50%. It kills more people. It killed 10% of those who got it. But worst of all, and this is typical of the flus we fear the most, it kills people who are the healthiest, those who have the strongest immune systems, because the people with a strong immune system fights the hardest to, you know, to destroy the virus, and the virus is not easily destroyed, and basically your immune system kills you, or at least makes you so weak that you die from something else, pneumonia, you know, you name it, anything that gets in there. So all those characteristics for a super flu do not appear to be present. In fact, the big mystery right now is, as far as the CDC is concerned, the flu in Mexico is the same as the one in the United States and popping up worldwide. But it's killed 150 out of, nobody knows, people who've got it in Mexico, and it's killed zero. But yeah, there was one death in the United States, but that was a Mexican child who was brought up into Texas for treatment of some other medical condition. So no Americans have died of this. The number is still kind of vague, because unless it's a really, you know, bad flu, a lot of people will have it and not even know it. I mean, maybe I do get flu. I've just never, you know, been feeling in a way, you know, when every time flu season comes around, I'm curious, you know, what's it like to have flu, at least once, right? I never seem to have had the combination, but that doesn't, I asked the doctor about it once, and he said, well, you might have had it, but a lot of people have it and they don't even know it, and so don't worry about it, so I don't. But now you have to worry about it, because it is basically a matter of numbers. How many people in Mexico have got it? For all we know, 10-20% of the Mexican population may have had it. But a lot of people would have it and say, you know, especially in Mexico City, the air, you know, if it's a bad smog day, you're going to feel sick. For a lot of people, that might have been the flu, not just, you know, congestion from the smog. And they're still trying to find it out. And, of course, the problem in Mexico is there's not, you know, the health care isn't the best. A lot of people are poor and are, you know, not eating right. And so they have, you know, poor immune system relative to the United States. And so they've never really bothered to look at it. Now, one good thing's going to come out of it. The epidemiologists are going to get a much better look of the, you know, the health of Mexicans as a whole. In the United States, it's a similar problem. Although people are looking very hard for, you know, swine flu cases, they're getting a lot of false, you know, people coming in saying, Doc, I think I got it, and they check them, and they, no, you got something else, or you got nothing at all. So right now, bottom line, doesn't look like another pandemic.
Right. Austin, you wrote an interesting article on Wednesday about this whole thing, about how it's being used just to drum up fear.
Well, I called it epidemic of fear. I don't make the connection that there's some great controlling intelligence out there using it to drum up fear. I think it's rather pathetic in the way that context is not provided by a lot of the reporting that I've read. There are a few. There's some excellent reports out there, but they seem to be a handful. Most of them were of the nature, when Jim brought up the child who died in Texas, it says, Texas child dies. Child dies in Texas.
That's the news business. They need headlines.
Okay, let me, fine. It's the news business. It's the wrong way to run the news business. Especially.
It's the right way if you want to stay in business.
What it is, is when you do face a potentially dangerous situation, the last thing you need to do is incite public panic. And you may be.
Unless you want to sell newspapers. I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
They're habitually sensationalist, Jim.
Exactly.
And that's it. And they can't draw the line when there's something out there that has a potential to be a mass killer. Notice the way I put it. Potential to be a mass killer. The other point is that in Jim's fine introduction, he provided historical depth. He even provided some of the numbers. How, if you would give Dunnigan the airtime, he could cut down that intro to about 90 seconds. It'd take at least that time to cover it to give you historical context. A lot of the fear that's inside it would not, by the short, punchy headline and the dread that it's coming to get you and to fear other people, it wouldn't be incited. Common sense would rule, and people would say, oh, this is something where we need to take precautions. And then you could go through the checklist, and there are checklists out there by emergency management people, by health, public health officials, by, well, gee, your grandmother could be following a checklist. Let me give you the grandmother's checklist before I go back to the epidemic of fear and the larger checklist. Your grandmother's checklist. Wash your hands. Stay home if you feel poorly, because that's part of the way that you would break your own actions, break an epidemic cycle. Those are key things to do in any kind of epidemic situation, but they do break the quote unquote connectivity of a virus flu epidemic. Washing your hands is absolutely essential. Dan, if I sound like your grandmother, well, I'm glad you have a grandmother that tells you to wash your hands, because she's dead right. That's one of the best things that you could do to avoid spreading a flu virus. Jim hit the big picture of that, which is general public health issues, public health conditions in many places in Mexico, not everywhere, but many places in Mexico, are not at all comparable to what we have in the United States. And that's one of the issues at play in the issue of both transmissibility as well as fatalities. Those are categories of analysis that get obscured by much of the reporting, which only relies on discussions about virulence. We don't know what the virulence of this virus is yet. That takes some time to both type it and to watch how the disease progresses, and to spend time in the reporting on what we don't know. And there is a great deal we don't know, at least yet. The last thing to do in a situation like that, in my view, is to incite panic. And this morning, I noticed the Vice President of the United States doesn't want to go on subways. I don't know if you caught that report.
I saw that Crazy Uncle Joe got on the TV.
All right. You said the Vice President of the United States. I think that is the wrong message to be sent by a public leader. It is, you know, we're researching this. We know that it's a potential threat. Heavens, precautionary quarantines, particularly in border states like the one I live in, like Texas, that makes sense. That goes through some of the cycle that local and state and regional emergency management personnel and public health officials can make a call. There's an element, instead of inciting panic with that, that can actually be reassuring. Look, we don't know. We're having this checked out. We are going to precaution, we're going to shut down the schools for a couple of days. We're going to recommend that you follow these procedures at home. That's the way to handle the political side of it. Now, as for the scientific side, I think Jim hit most of the points. I use the 36,000 flu fatalities a year in the United States in my column this week. I got that figure off of the Centers for Disease Control website. They provide that, and it's just like Jim said, those 36,000 people a year in the United States who die from flu, do die from flu-related illnesses. Usually the flu weakens their immune system, and they get a pneumonia or some other infection. Now, how many people a year in the United States catch the flu? Jim said, you know, we really don't know. It could be far larger because it's not expressed in many people. Many people, they say they don't catch it, but they've got it. They've carried the bug, but their bodies fought the flu off. There are numbers out there that suggest that on an average flu year, anywhere from 40 to 90, that's a big number, 40 to 90 million Americans. Remember, there are about 310 million Americans. Okay. But you're saying anywhere from 10 to 12% of the population to perhaps maybe between 25 and 30% have the flu or come in contact with the flu or have flu-like symptoms. As Jim said, remember, There are all kinds of common colds that have a virus base to them. That is a remarkably low fatality rate. And yet, that's what goes on every year, 36, 40,000, sometimes a little bit less, Americans die from the flu. I'd like to see, and I think this is a key to responsible support reporting, not sensationalism, I'd like to see that figure referred to saying, look, folks, we face this all the time. It is a constant threat. That's why we have public health. That's why we have the Centers for Disease Control. That's why we do so many things we do, including now over the last, well, I think it's 4 or 5 years, we've been stocking antivirals regionally of public health institutions because of the possibility of a return of a Spanish-type flu. And Jim talked about 1918 and 1919. It was a genuine global health threat. Could it come back? Yes. Do I see the elements of a Spanish flu in what's going on now in 2009? I'm going to go right along with Dunnigan. No, I don't. I see a problem. I don't see a disaster.
Right. Now, one of the things...
Back in the 80s and 90s... go ahead, Ken.
Well, go ahead. You're probably going
to
talk about...
Back in the 80s and 90s, I used to travel to Washington a lot, you know, and people want me down there to talk about this or that. And some of the people I spoke to were epidemiologists, the people who study the statistics of disease, from the CIA and the Defense Department, and I think there were a few CDC people in some of those meetings. And they came to me because I knew a lot about, you know, combat, historical combat casualties and things like that. And, you know, the flu came up and, you know, other diseases, and they were very matter-of-fact. In fact, what I'm saying is I got a sense of how these people would brief the president. So I assume he has been briefed. They would say basically the same thing that I just said. They would say, well, Mr. President, this is what the flu does normally. This is what the flu does abnormally. And it's very simple. Normally, 5 to 15%, as far as they can tell. I mean, there's two sets of data on how many people catch the flu. And this I've learned from my epidemiologist friends. The reported illnesses, 5 to 15% a year, because every year it's a different, you know, strain. These are people who come into the doctor or whatever, reported that, hey, I'm feeling like crap. But they've run other tests where they take a random sample of a population during flu season, and those are the numbers Austin was referring to.
Yeah,
in some cases, they feel that
it's over a huge 50 spectrum of numbers, man.
Exactly, but the killer, so to speak, is what percentage of the people who are infected die? Now, using the public health figures, not the epidemiologist, you know, random sample thing, which they don't run all the time, it's 1 in 1,000 of those 5 to 15% of the population who get it, you know, die from it. Now, that's pretty low. And mostly it's very young, very old, people who are in danger. These people who are at risk, whether the flu's there or not. The worst case is the pandemic of the Spanish flu. And that, historically, they can't track. I mean, flu has been around forever, at least in Eurasia. Cannot find in the historical record a flu epidemic that bad. And we're talking in terms of, you know, percentage of population infected and percentage of people infected who died. That one is the gold standard, so to speak, for how bad influenza can get. And in that case, let's just for rounding things off, 50% infected, 10% died. Actually, a little less than that. Because they estimate maybe 3-4% of the world population died. And at that point, the world population was about 1.9 billion. Now, going back to the president's briefing, if this virus came back and they were able to resurrect it, so to speak, from bodies buried in the Arctic, because it even got that far north, it reached everywhere, and they were able to reconstruct it. That something happened recently, and it's locked up in a vault along with the smallpox, you know, virus. If that redeveloped in the wild, and they think and since they've seen it, they've realized that it would be very rare for it to it could happen again. It will happen again, but it's not something that's likely to happen again because now they've actually seen the virus and were able to examine it. But this is not 19. This is 90 years ago. This thing popped up. Medicine has changed a lot. We have a lot of medicines first of all, we can create vaccines, which they didn't have for influenza back then. Although, the trouble with vaccines is you're shutting the door after the horse is arrived. In other words, you have to guess every year what strain is going to be, preeminent. But there are a lot of other medicines you can give to treat the secondary effects of influenza. In other words, when it weakens the immune system, we can treat that. So we would probably never have a death rate as high as the one in 1919. We're talking, at least in the industrialized countries, death rates of maybe 1% of the population or less. Now, that's still a lot, for one disease. But it's not as scary as it would be in places like Africa and parts of Asia where they haven't got the medical care to deal with the secondary effects of influenza. The bottom line is the president, senior government officials, they've been briefed just as I briefed you right now, using the facts, the historical facts and the medical facts. What is happening, as Austin pointed out in his column, was it's a media feeding frenzy. Their eyes light up with something like this. Nothing gets people going more than a communicable disease, a plague. That's always big news. As we used to joke about, back in the days when we were designing games, hey, if you want to liven up a game, put in a bubonic plague. Gets people's attention. It's the news business, unfortunately. There's no getting away from it. You're not going to see the president's briefing, so to speak, on the news because it's not news.
Right. Now, what do you think?
Dan, let me make a couple of quick points. Notice
go
when
ahead.
Jim says approximately 100,000. If there are 36,000 deaths flu-related in the United States, that's 36 million, 1 in 1,000. And that's that low figure.
No. The people who are infected.
Yeah.
In other words, 5% are infected. 1 in 1,000 of those who are infected die from it.
Yeah, well, my point is, though, is that if you start playing with those numbers, the statistical suspicion is that many, many, many more people a year than the low ball.
Yes, but then the mortality numbers change.
Contact with the disease.
In other words, if 50% getting it, then it's 1 in 10,000 are dying.
Yeah.
There's two sets of infected numbers. There's the ones, the public health numbers, where the person who's infected gets into the public health system. In other words, they're so sick, it's reported. But then I said the epidemiological, where they do every few years or whatever, they go out and during flu season, they take blood samples from a random sample of a population and tell people who feel perfectly healthy, hey, you had the flu.
That's where you begin to see those larger numbers. Let me make another point, too, about the dynamics that Jim pointed out. All right, there are some dynamics that make transmissibility in the early 21st century a real issue, and that is jumbo jets, rapid international travel on aircraft. And one of the things about aircraft is that you're sharing air in close proximity, and you could be sharing a space where someone just flew in from Singapore, somebody else flew in from New Guinea, somebody else from London, somebody from Moscow, and you got on the aircraft in Mumbai. And there is that scenario. It is a real concern. At the same time, where you've got the age of proximity, where everyone is close to one another as a disease pool, you've got the other factors, as Jim said, modern medicine, not simply energized by the great research of the early and mid 20th century, but the emergence of bioengineering, genetic engineering, and the ability to provide a genotype of the virus very quickly to identify what its vulnerabilities are. We really have some outstanding medical techniques. Again, it takes time to do this, but far less time than in the past, and there are things we can do to surge both vaccines and in some cases surge medicines that if they can't attack the virus directly, as Jim talked about, mitigating the secondary symptoms. And sometimes those are the ones that are the ones that produce the fatalities. We have got so many options out there that this is what I think should be another element of, I'm getting back to it again, responsible reporting about what the threats of the virus are and the way a pandemic would be managed in the first decade of the 21st century.
Okay.
Something else to remember about the 1919 pandemic. First of all, that was the first influenza pandemic. I mean, influenza virus, where you had world communication. In other words, they didn't have airplanes, but they had ships. And although it moved more slowly, it took weeks instead of days for an population to reach the entire planet. That was the first time you had basically intercontinental transportation, regular transportation. Secondly, several million of those deaths during the 1919 plague were a result of the war, World War One, which had impoverished and basically was widespread famine for any number of reasons. I mean, there was a famine in India because they were shipping, food out for the war effort and what have you. There was a worse one in World War Two. But in other words, there were a lot of people who were weakened. The Spanish flu was particularly bad in the prisoner of war camps because they were just, clearing those out. And among many populations in Eastern Europe, which had undergone famine because the war was moving back and forth and what have you, and there was a civil war going on in Russia. But as Austin points out, we have much better means to deal with situations like that. And, of course, we don't have the situation in 1919 of, a huge world war going on. We're much better prepared to deal with influenza on its own terms. And at the same time, we know for a fact that the death rate in the United States is zero right now. We found hundreds of people who we've examined, their sputum, whatever, their samples, and we've identified this strain of influenza, but nobody has died from it yet.
Right. Now, one of the things my devious little mind started thinking about was, what about, Ahmed, who's sitting on the Pakistani-Afghanistan border, and he's watching CNN, and he's seeing all the panic and hysteria going on. He goes, hey, this is pretty cool. How could I cause the same sort of thing? Is it possible for me to go down to my friend there in Islamabad and that's a biologist and get him to cook something up?
No, I mean, this has always been a great, theoretical fear that given the spread of biotechnology, in other words, it's become cheaper, more accessible, and what have you, there has not yet appeared a Islamic, radical who is a qualified, biologist who can basically do gene splicing. I mean, eventually that might be the case. They would have a much better shot at spreading anthrax, which they haven't done, or glanders. I mean, there's any number of naturally occurring diseases that do not menace the West simply because we have controlled them or destroyed them. Polio is the most effective Islamic biological weapon because in Pakistan, in Taliban country, they are interfering with the inoculation. They're trying to destroy the polio like they did smallpox 30 years ago, but it's being held up in Islamic countries, in Africa and in Asia, because they've started the rumor that the polio vaccination is basically a Western plot to make young Muslim girls sterile. And a lot of people believe that, and they back it up by, keeping out the immunization teams. I mean, that's ignorance and it's the same thing with the news business in the West.
I was going to say, it sounds just like our newspapers.
Exactly, except over there they call them religious fanatics. But that is an effective, but it operates, it kills their own people.
Right.
And that's what would happen. That's the big problem if you play around with biological warfare. Unless you can immunize your own, quietly and secretly immunize your own population against it, or somehow manufacture a biological weapon that always kills, you know, non-Muslims. Good luck with that.
Right.
It's going to kill more of your people than it will of their people. Although I suppose for some, you know, Al-Qaeda, you know, that makes perfect sense. But, you know, right now the threat of an Islamic biological weapon is pretty close to zero. Won't stay that way forever, but right now you can take some comfort.
Give you the final word, Austin.
To some degree, we're writing a screenplay or a good thriller novel when we and these are also when I say a good thriller novel or a screenplay, the terrorist produces a genetically engineered virus or bacterium and then threatens the entire city. I mean, we've seen this this plot before, and then you've got the doctors trying to find a cure or a preventative mechanism as the police go after the terrorists. And could that happen? Sure. The thing is, though, the likelihood of it is extremely small. The science behind the terrorist, as well as terrorist ability to acquire it, there's a great deal of iffiness that the that you could produce sufficient quantities to begin with, much less be able to deliver them to the quote unquote public to the reservoir or get it or disperse it by aircraft over an area. They are concerns, of course, but we've seen it in the movies, and people are prepared to believe that the movies are real. Part of my objection to the reporting. The reporting tends to move towards the Hollywood instead of the factual, and that's
Hollywood sells. Facts don't.
I'm sorry?
Hollywood sells better than facts.
Yeah, back to sensationalism, and we're actually dealing with a threat, you know, a real-world threat, okay?
Well, you know, for years, the only reason...
I'm gonna stop. This is the time you aren't sensationalist.
Well, no, for years, and it's still to this day, I get into little tiffs with the television news producers, because... And then, you know, bit by one, they caught on to what I was doing because I haven't changed my pitch. They said, Jim, you make the truth sound exciting, but you're the only one that can do that. We have to sell sensationalism. And then, you know, I'll never forget the one guy who whispered in my ear as I was going on to do a bit. He says, scare them, Jim. He didn't say please, but it was sort of implied. They basically sell fear. I mean, that's the news business has always been like that. And you know, when sometimes they come back at me, about that, and I said, look, it's the business. You can't survive without selling fear. And some of them kind of look a little sheepish and, you know, consider other career alternatives. But for anybody who's really into it, hey, if it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
I've had people joke about that on the set, you know, the talent, you know, the anchors and what have you. I mean, you can say, and you look around, you can tell some of them say, eh, I wish I was somewhere else, you know. But that's just the way the business works. More people are getting media savvy, but most are not. You know, they used to talk about media literacy. There are some people who have always been media literate, and they become political consultants or PR specialists. But most of the population is just at the mercy of this stuff, more
right.
so than they are at the mercy of the flu. You can turn the TV off, but you can't. Right, anyway, go ahead.
Maybe that's the whole solution for this is just to turn your TV off and go about what you're doing and keep washing your hands.
It's true. That's a good recommendation, Dan.
and maybe a good place for us to
turn the TV off and the faucet on.
Right. That's right. That's strategy page's recommendation is turn the TV off and keep washing your hands. Well, I think that's a good place to end. We've come to our time limit here, and we'll talk to you folks next week.
Till then.
All right. Bye. Bye.